There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
I remember well when the Reserve Bank was just a bond-selling agent of the Treasury.
He would not be willing to reconsider the Greek program.
A smaller-than-expected increase for consumer prices.
That the United States economy added almost 5 million jobs.
These numbers aren't anyone's opinions or political views.
This is the Debunking Economics Podcast with Steve Keen and Phil Dobby.
The idea of debt deflation, we're in debt while prices are going down. We seem a long way from that now, don't we? But could that be just around the corner? And what about the man who focused his work on how debt and deflation can cause and have caused great depressions? American Irving Fisher, one of the influencers of Steve Keen. Today, we talk about Irving Fisher with Steve. We talk about the man and his theories. That's this week on the Debunking Economics Podcast. So, yeah, this week and actually for the next 5 weeks, that's going to take us over the whole Christmas period and into next year, whatever year that will be. What will that be? 2023.
Oh, so. Hey, well, you are getting ahead of yourself.
I am.
What, 2022 wasn't bad? And you want even more catastrophe
next
year?
I just want to get over this period of
history.
You
know my line about this particular decade. It's the hold my beer decade, okay? So 2020 was bad enough. We start with COVID.
Yeah.
2021, we had the January uprising and a range of other catastrophes. I've simply forgotten. 2022, energy crisis, the war, etc. 2023, it's no longer a case of happy New Year. It's holy fuck New Year.
Yeah. What can happen to us now?
You want to jump 1 year forward ahead of
I would.
You're
I
on
do.
Your own, mate.
Because,
you're
well,
on your
no,
own.
But yeah, because you think it's going to be worse. No, I just want to get over whatever 2023 is going to throw at us.
It used to be a case of, throwing the New Year's party, happy New Year, kiss the girlfriend, blah, blah, blah.
Now
grabbing your nails and you're being dragged from 1 year into
the next. Going, oh my God. Well, it's got to get better, hasn't it? Surely at some point. But anyway, look, over this next few weeks, or next 5 weeks, we're going to look at a bunch of economists who you think we should know more about. And I guess a lot of these are people who have influenced your thinking.
Very much so.
And so they're not the sort of mainstream economists. Some of them people will never have heard of. But we're going to start this week with one that possibly is familiar to a number of people, Irving Fisher.
Indeed, yep.
American economist. He was sort of around, well, he straddled the 19th and 20th century. He died in 1947, went to Yale, smart guy. One of his books was The Purchasing Power of Money in 1911, when he looked at the relationship between money supply and price levels, which is what, isn't that what we'd call monetary theory?
It's pretty much, straight. There's a straight line from that sort of thinking to Milton Friedman's monetarism, definitely.
Right.
And it's also like, you had debates over the nature of money going, I forgot the currency school versus the, and I've forgotten the name of the other one just momentarily. But you have the different approaches to money, which go back, two or three centuries. And fundamentally, the quantity theory of money is all the way through. And at this point, Fisher was continuing the quantity theory of money approach.
Right. So what is the quantity theory of money?
And well, basically,
it was around before. He didn't invent it, though, did he?
No. Right. I mean, the banking school versus the currency school, they were the two classical debates. And you had people saying, the currency was, there's a fixed relationship between the stock of money and the level of output. And the banking school, fundamentally, the endogenous money approach that I'm part of, you don't have that fixed relationship. But if you look at Milton Friedman...
But hang on, just on that first one, because we're going to have to do this step by step, because I know we've got quite a few new listeners and they're going to be almost in the same boat I am.
God.
We need to be handheld through all of this. I mean, we've been doing this for 6 years. I still need to be handheld through it all. But okay, a fixed relationship between the amount of money and output.
Yeah. And
which is crazy, isn't it? Because we do know it's to do with the speed. I mean, anything is to do with the speed at which money circulates.
That's the velocity of money turning up as well. But but fundamentally, I mean, if you look at, and we're going off tangent here as we always do. But if you look at Milton Friedman's main intellectual contribution like, you know, we all know for the quantity theory of money and so on. What he really saw as his main contribution was the monetary history of the United States. And he wrote that largely to prove the counterfactual, as it was a counterfactual, that the velocity of money is relatively constant. No, now, it isn't.
No,
it isn't.
We know that because it's been slowing down for
decades.
Slowing
down, and it fluctuates with the trade cycle and so on. And even some of his own acolytes, and like if you look at the work of Kidlin and Prescott, they did empirical work and completely contradicted the idea that it was constant. But a large part of Friedman's argument was velocity is like a given, and therefore, and he said money drives the inflation level. So you had money times the velocity of money equals the price level times effectively real output, the level of transactions. And by saying that the velocity was constant and money was determined by the government, this is the whole helicopter argument, then you got the proposition that changes in money cause changes in the price level.
Right.
And you insulate our real output from... So it's the monetary value that varies in that, and it's all driven by naughty government money creation. So that stage, let's go back to Fisher again. What you've got is somebody who's really believes in the mainstream paradigm and is extending the mainstream paradigm. And that's where he began, and that's not where he ended up.
Right. Okay. So what was his belief then? If we're saying that, okay, output is not specifically related to the quantity of money?
He was a straight... like when he did his PhD and when he became famous as well, he was very much a mainstream extender of Volra's model. The idea that you had a price system which determined equilibrium. Equilibrium is an essential component of his analysis of capitalism, et cetera, et cetera. So he was very much the mainstream. He was very mathematically talented. And also he was a tinkerer. And this is one fascinating thing, which he shares in common with Phillips, which is quite an intriguing contrast. He actually built a hydraulic calculation machine.
Because there weren't computers around in those days. So if you wanted
about 100 years before computers.
So if you wanted to include multiple factors, you needed to build a machine. Hmm. And he built it using
hydraulics. He built a machine to calculate equilibrium price levels.
Right.
So it was Volra's concept of a set of prices. And out of that, he got this idea that you could... using hydraulics, you could have different utility. If you had people with marginal utility at one extent, you had marginal cost at the other. Multiple commodities involved in the whole thing, and you'd vary the amount of water in different parts of the system. Again, very much like Phillips's later hydraulic machine, and it would then calculate the optimal price ratios given the utility functions you had at one side and the cost functions on the other for multiple markets.
So this is his general equilibrium model. This
very
is
much
like,
general
like
equilibrium.
The 1800s. Late 1800s, 1891, I think he submitted his paper on this. So what was so? But he was arguing then that there was that you know, which you've always said is not the case. That
he found out the hard way that it wasn't the case, and this is the fascinating thing about him, because
case being that the economy is in equilibrium, it is either going from or heading back to some point of equilibrium.
Yeah, and his PhD thesis was published as a book, The Theory of Interest. That was his major contribution. And before you got all the nonsense coming out of Sharpe and co and the efficient markets hypothesis, that was the mainstream interpretation of finance. And fundamentally, everything the mainstream do is trying to shoehorn reality into a pair of intersecting supply and demand curves.
Okay? Yeah.
So what he argued, again, he applied this idea to what is the rate of interest. And of course, have interest, you've got to be borrowing money. So therefore, you have debt, and debt, therefore, is a stock of accumulated debt. Borrowing in the past becomes current stock of debt. And to maintain the assumption of equilibrium in that market, you had to have a vision of equilibrium through time. So as part of his theory of interest, he said he assumed that debts are repaid. Okay, all debts are repaid. And he assumed that the market is in equilibrium not merely at this point in time, but through time as well. And those are the essential assumptions he made. And he acted upon those assumptions himself in his own private life, which led to him being enormously wealthy and then enormously bankrupt on the other side.
Right. So, is he wrong on that all debt has to be repaid?
Absolutely he's wrong. I mean, he's right that it has to be legally. He's wrong that it is practically.
Right.
And then the consequences of not being repaid are disastrous, as he found out himself in the Great Crash. But so you had somebody who had, first of all, that he was a tinkerer and a very good tinkerer. I mean, making his mechanical models is incredibly gifted.
And he was fascinated, wasn't he, by complex modelling, basically. That was his. So it wasn't just in economics, because he developed a mechanical diet indicator to calculate daily consumption of fats, carbohydrates and proteins. This was in 1903. So it wasn't just economics. Mm, mm. I think anything where there was a whole load of variables that somehow interplayed, he wanted to build a model for it, a mechanical model for it.
If Fisher had been around at the time of the transistor was invented, he would have been making the first computers. He was definitely somebody whose interest crossed over into engineering and science rather than just being related to economics. And he was also, of course, you probably discovered, a prohibitionist.
Right. No, I didn't know that.
You didn't know that? No. He was probably better known for being a teetotal and anti-alcohol and in favour of prohibition than he was economics.
Right.
So he had quite a wide range of talents. But
this is what you can do if your brain isn't muddied by alcohol and other substances, isn't it?
I think it's actually an argument in favour of alcohol, frankly, and other muddying substances. So he had the prohibitionist, which made him, again, a public figure, because supporting prohibition during prohibition was definitely something that, you know, the dominant political interest at the time liked, but it made you pretty unpopular. People who thought a speakeasy was a good place to go for an unwind. So, you know, gave him a controversial picture there as well. But the most important thing in terms of why he had such public prominence was also his tinkering. Have you discovered that you said that he made the first Rolodex?
No, I didn't know that.
The Rolodex. Now, this for those youngins in the audience here. Like, a Rolodex is a physical version of your contact list.
Yeah, before you had it on computer on your mobile phone.
So he made it as a rotary device. He again made it himself back at home.
Yeah.
And it had A to Z, and you'd rotate the thing and go A, B, C, D, etc. Find it. You know, if you're looking for Marshall, and you go to M, and then there's look for under A Marshall. There's his details. You pull the card out. Well, he sold that to the Rand Corporation in return for shareholdings in Rand plus money, and then he invested on margin in the stock market during the 1920s. And you'll find writings of him later where he decries the use of margin debt. Good reason being that's what drove him bankrupt.
Right. Okay.
So, like, he borrowed. He was worth something, like, in terms of rough $2,000. He was worth something like about $10 million, courtesy of his deal with the Rand Corporation.
So even back then, because I think of you know, the Thatcher era as being the era where debt became good. You know, that, like, you know, my mum and dad were always taught me that, you know, don't spend money if you haven't got it.
Mm.
The exception being perhaps, you know, when you're taking out a mortgage. But even then, don't overstretch yourself.
Yeah.
Now, of course, I have overstretched myself because everybody else does, because you have to be able to afford a house.
Yeah.
But also, people borrow now to invest, which was unthinkable. I thought that was sort of like a Thatcher era thing.
No,
here you are, saying, here we are, turn of the century.
There is some potential commonality with the COVID period we're going through now, and because the Spanish flu hit in, I think, 1917 and 1918, killed more people than got killed in the First World War. People were wearing masks. You had the mask, anti-mask, pro-mask stuff happening at that time as well. And then it disappeared. There's still no – there must be in the technical literature some explanation of why it petered out, but it did peter out. And then you had the 1920s. And, like, this was after some inflation during the First World War, which reduced the level of private debt. And then it was all – let's party. I mean, the 1920s was the party decade,
yeah.
You know, the roaring 20s.
Yeah.
And it roared on borrowed money. So what you – and this is one remarkable thing that I found by looking at level of margin debt, because now when you borrow on margin, you have to pay – if you put down $500,000, you can buy $1 million worth of shares. But in his time, you put down – $500,000, you could buy $5 million because the margin ratio was 10.
Right.
Okay, so you could buy $5 million worth of shares with $500,000 worth of your own cash.
Because they didn't know what was coming up in the 1930s.
Well, they didn't, but they did. What I decided to do is look at the level of margin debt. And there's a wonderful database called the Global Financial We're getting miles away from
Yeah, that's all right. We'll get back to it.
You see, the Global Financial Database, and that included data on margin debt prior to the current records, which started, I think, about 1956. And like from 1956 data through to now, margin debt never exceeded 3% of GDP. Okay. Still a substantial amount of money that's borrowed to gamble on share prices. Mm. But you'll see spikes in 2000, 2007, and pretty much now as well, hitting about 3%. When I normalize the data that I got from the Global Financial Database to match the later data, the level of margin debt in 1920 began at 1% of GDP and peaked in October 1929 at 13% of GDP.
Right.
So that's such an enormous level. And, of course, everybody was taking out margin loans with a 10-to-1 ratio. Now, the idea was if you got a 10% gain in the market, you doubled your the market goes up 10%, you go, you borrow $100,000. You have $100,000. You buy $1 million worth of shares. They rise in value by 10%. They go from $1 million to $1.1 million. Compared to your $100,000, you've doubled your money.
Okay. Right.
So that was the attraction of margin debt, but it meant the opposite ratio. If you had you had $100,000, bought $1 million worth of shares, they gained it by 10%. Your entire capital is wiped out.
So hence your point about debt isn't always repaid, as he discovered to his cost.
Yeah.
But is that? I mean, you'd be thinking, well, okay, if I'm borrowing to invest, then that is money which is being used to help companies grow, which is garbage, because you buy the shares on the secondary market, you're buying
up another speculator.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I wonder if he I mean, he must have realized that.
If you read, he was actually in the same situation as Paul Krugman. Because he was a columnist for the New York Times,
right.
and re-quoted, you've just been fired numerous newspaper articles on Fisher's opinion of this, that, and the other. Not a regular column so much as Krugman's, but he was literally being read by people. And because he was saying that when the stock market was booming, that was natural and sensible, and when the crash hit, it was a lunatic fringe. We have to wait for the lunatic fringe to disappear. And he made the famous comment September 1929, that shares seem to have reached what appears to be a permanently high plateau. Now, that's more most people ever see of the quote. But he's actually referring to the quotes of, I'm thinking of Babbage, but I've got the name wrong. But there was another, he was a bull commentator, and there's a bear commentator in the same newspaper. He said, I doubt that there will ever be, as Mr. Babbage is saying, a 10 or 20% fall in the value of shares. Well, 3 weeks later, that happened in one day. And he was initially in panic. You can read this, what's going on? This is the crazy lunatic fringe. Wait till it settles out. He was wiped out of margin debt. And the only reason he didn't have to declare bankruptcy was his wife's sister was very wealthy, and she lent him money to pay back the margin calls and forgave the debts on her deathbed.
So he was the lunatic fringe himself, because he did.
He didn't realize. He was a lunatic center. Everybody charging off the same cliff with literally margin debt reaching 13% of GDP.
So he did write about over speculation because of that lunatic fringe.
After that experience.
Because they didn't know what they were doing.
He was the lunatic.
Yeah.
Okay.
But he liked investment trusts. He said, you're better off with investment trusts because they are experts, not the lunatic fringe. And the experts know what they're doing. They know how the market is going to go.
And I think the best account of that is a wonderful old movie, Trading Places, with, what's his name, the Dan Aykroyd and I've forgotten the other actor, the leading actor.
I have not seen the movie.
Oh, you should see it. It's wonderful. Mm. It's basically everybody is hanging on. This is where Keynes's wisdom comes in. So he said it's better to fail conventionally than to succeed unconventionally. So the whole idea that you would the experts, they're sharing the same delusions.
Mm.
They amplify each other, and that's what he realized. The trusts weren't at all experts in ways of getting the right stock market. They were. Yet again, ways of perpetuating the bubble.
And he didn't like capital gains tax because he said that would mean owners of stocks that have greatly increased in value would be reluctant to sell them because they didn't want to pay the capital gains tax. So they'd hang on to them. Therefore, that would add to the value of those stocks. So I don't know whether that's a good thing or a bad thing. Maybe he was writing all of this when he was trying to, see his stocks.
Well, he was becoming an extremely wealthy person. He was literally in terms of what he was worth in terms of dollars current dollars, he's probably worth $100 or $200 million.
Yeah.
Okay. He wasn't Elon Musk levels of wealth, but he was extremely wealthy. And then it was all gone in a matter of days in 1929.
So is that when he started focusing on debt then?
Yeah, because he's
because he had first-hand experience of it.
First-hand experience.
Because debt deflation, I think, is part and parcel of his body of work.
Absolutely essential. That's the major contribution. The lasting contribution he's made is the debt deflation theory of Great Depressions.
Okay, now we understand how he got there because he experienced it firsthand. We'll look at that after the break on the Debunking Economics podcast.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
This is the Debunking Economics podcast with Steve Keen and Phil Dobby.
Well, we are looking this week, and actually for the next 5 weeks, we are looking at economists that you should know about. Today it's Irving Fisher. We've looked in the first part about how he was a man who got himself into debt, and then from spending a lot of time talking about the stock market because he was heavily invested in it, in fact, overly leveraged in it, and then paid the price of that, he started looking at debt and debt deflation.
And also disequilibrium, and this is the essential thing that, like,
he'd been a proponent of equilibrium thinking.
Everything was thinking in equilibrium.
Yeah.
And then he realized, but looking back, you know, because he had an incredible meteoric rise, and then equally a meteoric collapse. Where do you get the idea of a meteoric rise from? Like a meteor rises from the surface of the planet?
Yeah,
that's a wrong analogy. Before, but a bit inverted. Meteors tend to... Well, he did the reverse meteor, the standard meteor on the other side of the stock market crash and was wiped out. He only survived in a long-term sense, A, because of his sister-in-law forgiving his debts to her, but B, Columbia University gave him a free house as well.
That's nice.
That's why he wasn't homeless. And so it was an incredible shock to his system. And so he was saying, where did I mislead myself, was really his orientation. So he looked back at that thing about debts must be repaid and the market isn't always in equilibrium through time, to realize both of those were false. Debts weren't repaid, and there are periods where markets are massively disequilibrium. There's too much of this, too little of that. And so the debt deflation theory starts from a proposition the market is out of equilibrium. Now, that means when a neoclassical reads it, that line just disappears. They can't see the words out of, they just see equilibrium. Mm. So you read Bernanke's attempt to interpret Fisher, and it completely misses that essential element. And he again says, nominal debtors, because it's all the fact was debts in nominal terms rather than real terms. If you borrowed in real terms, it wouldn't be a problem. This sort of nonsense neoclassicals come up with all the time. So they can't interpret him properly. But he basically said, the beautiful statement from Keynes to say that equilibrium is blither, which he didn't actually write down. But he said to imagine that the markets are in perfect equilibrium is to imagine that the Atlantic can be without a wave. And that's the way that Fisher put it across. So the market will never be such a thing. Yes, you can imagine an equilibrium for the Atlantic Ocean. Will it ever be in it? No. There'll always be waves. You'll be above or below equilibrium.
But they are on an axis, though, aren't they? I mean, so is that a good analogy? I mean,
no.
It's because those waves are, the Atlantic Ocean is...
Well,
the volume of water in the Atlantic Ocean.
You can do a gravitational calculation, and say with the mass of water in it, if it's perfectly flat, then this will be the equilibrium level of the Atlantic.
Right.
Okay.
But it's always rising above or below that point of equilibrium.
Yeah. And the fluctuating of the side of it. Are the fluctuations going to be uniform, so like a plus and minus cancel each other out, and you might as well. No, this is the other thing. There's a when you get into a nonlinear system, the equilibrium does not have to be the attractor, the center around which it rotates. You can have more up a balance in one direction than you have in the down in the other. So the idea that the equilibrium will be the attractor is itself wrong. There's a beautiful piece by John Blatt in Dynamic Economic Systems. And if anybody wants to get a real grasp on the sort of economics we're talking about today and this work that I'm doing, buy that book. It's a beautiful piece of writing. But he explains at one point when he's talking about the Goodwin cycle, and we're going to talk about Goodwin as one of these economists later, he said that you have two factors go into the Goodwin cycle. One is the wages share of GDP, which is fundamentally income distribution because there are only two social classes in Goodwin's model. So what goes to workers is one minus what goes to capitalists. So you've got the wage distribution of income and then the employment rate. So you therefore think that the equilibrium of the system is going to be equilibrium value for wages and equilibrium value for the employment rate. But no, when you have the Phillips curve, as it should be, with nonlinear, it's not the equilibrium of the employment rate that's the center. It's the nonlinear transformation of that that's the center. So you don't get equilibrium is plus or minus, and everything cancels out, and you can forget about the non-equilibrium stuff.
Did he recognize that? Because he started talking about trade cycles almost, didn't he? We go through this period of never had it so good like he did, and then hits the fan. And but I have to say, what's it now? Because I don't want to get us off Apple. Apple take you off if you say swear words, or you've got to be we've got to mind our language.
We're going for a board. That's going to get me banned.
I think Dam's all right. Dam's all right. It's just So we've got these cycles. So you have it so good, and then of course you get this period of contraction because people have borrowed. Then they start. And I think this was his argument, wasn't it? You get to debt deflation. You've borrowed to such a point either you can't pay back those debts, or you panic and you pay back those debts. And then when you pay back those debts, you're in effect shrinking the money supply. So was he?
And
he was aware of the fact that the money supply was determined by the amount of debt.
This is where he starts breaking away from the Milton Friedman, because the monetarist attitude fundamentally is that the government controls the money supply, and therefore all the problems of the system are caused by the government creating too much or sometimes too little money, which is that was Milton Friedman's position decades later. But what Fisher realized, and he actually says this in Booms and Depressions, some first principles, which is a book that precedes writing The Debt Deflation Theory of Great Depressions, which is the very concise article. But in that, he says that a man-to-man debt is very different to a bank debt. He said, with a man-to-man debt, with a man-to-man debt, when a person who's in debt pays it down, the person who lent the money gets spending power returned.
Yeah, this is what we talked about last week.
But he then said when you have a bank debt, the money just simply disappears. And so that was an essential insight and this actually unites all of the people we're talking about except Goodwin, funnily enough. Goodwin doesn't actually understand money, which I find ridiculous because his grandfather was a banker, and the bank failed during the Great Depression, which threw the family into poverty.
Just because you work in a bank doesn't mean you understand the way the bank works.
I know plenty of people in the finance sector approve that on a daily basis. Hello! but that's the orientation is Goodwin leaves money out, but Fisher realizes the importance of the endogenous creation of money.
Right.
And so when you pay the bank debt down, you destroy money. And that therefore can give you what I call Fisher's paradox, and he expressed it as a paradox. The more debtors pay, the more they owe. But he didn't actually have the explanation of a cycle as much as Minsky did later. What Fisher began by saying, he said that you have to start from the proposition that all economic variables are above or below their ideal equilibrium. You're never going. Even if you did have a tendency towards it, the odds that you would be at equilibrium in any of those variables is vanishingly small. So you've got to start from a non-equilibrium position. He said the two most important things which give you non-equilibrium are excessive debt, too much debt, and too low a rate of inflation. So if you get a combination of too much debt with too low inflation, then you can have a process that leads to a collapse. And the idea was that, first of all, you have too much debt. Everybody's in too much debt. What's your reaction to the too much debt? You want to get money in so you can pay your debts down. How do you do that? You cut your prices. Okay. everybody does the same thing. They're all trying to attract entrance through
fast their, money, trying to get fast money by selling more.
You sell, so you drop your prices. Right. You then pay the debt off that you with the lower cash flow coming through the door. But because the prices have fallen, the real burden of debt has risen. He said, so this is the true paradox that defines the Great Depressions. The more debtors pay, the more they owe.
Right, because you borrowed money to produce whatever it is that you're producing, so your return on capital is less. Is that his argument?
Yeah. Right. And also because you destroyed the money supply. Right. And so if you do then see the money supply turning over and giving you GDP, then you have a reduction in GDP caused by the reduction in debt.
Right, but that sounds a little counterintuitive. If you're trying to get more money in because you've got too much debt, you lower your prices to try and get your turnover up, I guess, is his argument.
But if
times are good at that stage, I mean, right, okay, so the tide has turned.
The tide has turned.
Right, okay, so you're worried about the debt you're carrying because you can see the economy is starting to tank, so you go, okay, I've got to get, money in quickly.
If you look back at the monetary data from the 1920s, and this is, of course, endogenously created money, so it's bank credit and et cetera, et cetera. That peaked in about 27, 28. It's hard to find the precise data because you get data on an annual basis rather than monthly as we get now. But there was a decline in the turnover of money then. And Richard Vague's work here, which is extremely important, the stuff that Richard did in A Brief History of Doom, he found that there was, great book, Richard's one
I love
of my,
that title.
It's a great title. It's actually suggested to him by the publishers. It wasn't his own idea.
But it's just A Brief History because we couldn't cope with the full history
of
Doom.
Well, he's actually done full history as well in an illustrated manual from all the original.
But all those people who've read it have now committed suicide, unfortunately. So now it's just The Brief History because it's too much to take the full story of Doom.
Okay,
just stick with the brief one.
Okay, so Richard found that there was and I wasn't aware of this. There was a real estate bubble at the start of the 1920s. So frequently, even a crash we associate with a stock market crash began with a real estate bubble. Okay, so and this is what Ponzi was caught up in as well. The 1917, I think, the Ponzi scheme.
Yeah,
the in Florida when he started selling housing in a place that didn't exist. So you had all this real estate stuff kicking it off, and then it turned over into the stock market as well. And throughout the 1920s, while Calvin Coolidge was paying down government debt at the rate of 1% of GDP per year, and then saying that's what's causing this wonderful boom we're having, at the same time, on average, because it's very volatile, the annual increase in money supply was 5% a year because of people borrowing money.
Mm.
Okay, so the mainstream will focus just on the reduction in government debt and say, well, look, the boom conditions of the 1920s were created by Coolidge's surplus. You'll find the Austrians making this case all the time. The boom was actually created by the increase in private debt. And most of that went into real estate initially. Then it went into the stock market with this 10-to-1 leverage out of margin debt.
Right. Okay. So, people investing a chunk of it. But even if people were investing in a good way and putting it into businesses, and we spoke about this in a recent edition of the podcast as well.
Yeah.
I mean, everyone assumes that they are going to do better than they do in reality.
And therefore, you people borrow. There's an excessive investment. This is where Schumpeter is particularly important. Another one we'll talk about in one of the future podcasts. But, because everybody is trying to be the one who comes out on top.
Yeah.
And everybody's building, assuming that the market's going to grow. You know, their share of the market's going to grow faster than everybody else's share of the market. Well, you get overinvestment.
Yeah.
You borrow too much money, you can't support.
And I've seen that so many times firsthand, business models for startups. And you just go, there's no way in the world this is credible. And people just going, I know, but we've got to get the money. You know, it's like, if we're honest, no one would ever put money into anything, is the argument that is given time and time again.
So, and the euphoria is an essential part of the booms and vitality of capitalism as well. So it's a double-edged sword. And again, Richard's book makes this point. Back to Richard Vague's work now. So many of the benefits we have from, like the railway, for example, that gets me out to here, was caused by bubbles in real estate, which led to crashes. And the euphoria would take over the market so many times. And this, again, is an essential element of all the people we're talking about, bar again Richard Goodwin, that they realized that the extent to which financial euphoria was an essential part of the nature of capitalism and how destabilizing that is. But that instability is part of the creativity of capitalism as well.
So, in a nutshell, he's saying after this period of euphoria and overinvestment, we see people then trying to deleverage. They try and deleverage. They drop their prices to try and get as much cash in to try and deleverage.
Yeah.
That brings prices down, so we get deflation.
Yeah, and you get deflation means
and a shrinking of the money supply happening at the same
and
time.
And the burden of debt rises, even though the amount of debt's being the nominal debt is falling. The ratio of debt to GDP is rising. And when you look at the data, and again, this is what I find.
Why is that happening? Why is the
because when you're paying the debt down,
yeah.
Okay, your nominal debt falls, but you've cut your prices, so your GDP falls as well.
Well, right, okay.
And now that actually happened. You look at the data for the debt to GDP ratio in America, and I'm going from memory here. It peaks in about 1930-31, while the nominal debt's actually falling. So if you look at the debt to GDP ratio, you find its highest point is say. Again, I'm guessing. I've got to look it up in the data and fix it up. 31, 32. Okay, but you look at the debt and it's falling from 30 on. Okay, so you have this decline, negative credit, rising debt level, and the reason is the debt fell by about 10%, GDP fell by about 30%, and so you get a rising ratio, even though you've got a falling level of debt.
So. Has it been realised over and over since he made this observation? Is it the natural order of things? Yeah, but it's happening.
Well, it happened in 1987. It happened in 2000, 2007, but not with the same combination of deflation plus high levels of debt. So the one time we had that deflation, high levels of debt was 2007, and like you actually, if people don't realise this, the rate of inflation went from 5%, which is what it was in 2007. Before the crisis began, to -2 when you look at the monthly CPI data for America. So a 7% fall change in the rate of inflation from 5% to -2 very, very quickly. But then the reflation efforts the governments did the wrong way, but they still did it, meant that you didn't get that continued negative price changes. Whereas back in the Great Depression, from about 1930 to 33, every year the rate of inflation was -10%.
So he went from being an advocate of the economy being in equilibrium or on its way to it or from it, but somewhere hanging around that space, to one, I think this is him saying that it's in a constant state of disequilibrium.
Yep.
And there's three factors. There's growth or trend tendencies, which are steady. There's haphazard disturbances, which are unsteady.
Mm.
And then there are, which I guess is what he's talking about here, cyclical tendencies, which are unsteady but steadily repeated.
Yeah. But he didn't quite manage to get a mathematical formulation of that. So that's where, I think as much sense as I probably come in, because Minsky, when you look at Hyman Minsky's work, and we've spoken about Minsky recently, he's not one of our five we're talking about this particular slab. Mm. We should actually return to him, I suppose.
Yeah, we could. Yeah, well, maybe we'll make it number six, and we'll do Minsky in the new year.
Okay.
Yeah.
But he tried to build a mathematical model, and the mathematical model he built used Hicks's second-order difference equation model of the trade cycle, which became dominant in the 50s. And there's a slight link to Fisher in that particular case. But I proved, it's very, very simple, that Hicks's model is not a model. It's a mistake. So Minsky used the wrong foundation, and then I built the mathematical model that combined Fisher with Minsky to give you the debt deflation theory that I've built mathematically. Fisher never quite got there. So he had the verbal explanations of all this stuff but didn't get the mathematical form.
Right. And it seems a very simple explanation, doesn't it? I mean, the way you explain it, that, this rush to get money brings prices down, that creates deflation.
Yeah, yeah.
Seems very logical. It is in an isolated system, though, isn't it? It's like one country. It ignores the international environment, which complicates everything.
The international tends to be caught in the same euphoria. Mm. I mean, these things are shared. If you have a delusions growing in America, they'll be growing in the UK as well, and India, et cetera, et cetera. So
the more global the world is, the more the world behaves the same anyway, I think.
In a fundamental way,
So where are we in this now, then? Where are we in this cycle? Because we're in unusual times now.
Ours would be quite disturbing, even to Fisher. So we have inflation taking off now, that's, you can see the two.
But we've got heavy debt. Well, but then we've got
huge debt,
yeah.
Huge private debt as well. And in some ways, we're in a blockage because you're not going to see any great boom in credit coming out of current levels of debt because they're already so high. You're going to see probably a deflation coming out, a reduction in debt because now people are facing extremely high interest rates compared to what they thought they'd be facing. So there's going to be a need to liquidate.
People aren't bringing their prices down, though, to try and deleverage, aren't they?
That might start happening because
Because the opposite is happening right now. Huh? Everyone's going, oh, we've got to cover our costs. We've got to push our prices up.
Yeah, yeah, and they're getting inflationary surge. But if you start getting the debt burden, the servicing issue becoming major because of extremely high levels of debt and much higher interest rates than people expected on that debt when they took it out, then they're going to be forced to sell assets. So this often initially turns up in a desire to sell assets, non-financial assets, shares and houses, liquidate them and get the money and then pay your debt that way. But then that liquidation process itself starts to cause deflation because you get negative credit. So suddenly the government might be pumping up demand by running a deficit, but the private sector is running a negative. It's reducing its debt level, and that can undercut your demand, even with the government trying to stimulate the economy. Now, when you get governments around the world being obsessed with getting back into fiscal balance again, they're going in the opposite direction. So in that case, the governments will be reducing demand while the private sector is also reducing demand.
Yeah.
So that could give us, and I'm not going to say it's going to happen because it's such a weird time right now for the cost pressures.
And you've already climbed Mount Kosciuszko. You don't want to do that again.
No, I don't want to do it. No bets. No bets will be entered into. but definitely there are strong tendencies for credit reduction now. Reducing your debt is a major pressure.
Sure.
That will give us negative credit. The negative credit is probably going to come on top of governments also thinking they've got to get their fiscal balances nonsense they do. So the two together could give us a reversal of the price increases.
So we could be – because people are pushing prices up at the moment just because their cost of inputs are going up so much.
And that's the balancing thing. Three issues you're going to bring in for inflation. Markup by capitalists, okay? Yeah. Production costs and demand when wage demands by workers. We can write off the third as being the cause of the current inflation. Wages are well below the rate of inflation. You've got cost pressures because they're coming out of the COVID plus and energy issues as well, and high markups from capitalists because partly the monetary demand created by fiscal stimulus gave them the headspace to enable that to happen. You've got so much demand for the commodities which we could buy during COVID period, that nobody faced any pressure to reduce their prices. So you put your markups up, so high markups, but they could come down with a recession. It won't be the wages that fall; it could be the markups that fall.
Right, and then when that happens, we suddenly turn.
But then we've still got the issue of the cost pressures.
Yeah.
Okay, that's the one we can't control.
Yeah, which is a bit labor driven, isn't it? You know, it's overseas supply and domestic labor. That's what's driving it.
But also energy costs.
Yeah.
Okay. Energy costs start going through the roof then, and they will, because we're getting to the point where we're realizing just how the climate change issue, the critical role that fossil fuels are in the fragility of human civilization, let alone capitalism. So we're going to face all sorts of dynamics there.
Right. There's too much.
Too much.
Going on to influence his model now, isn't it, in a way? Because he wasn't, what was it? These are the haphazard disturbances which are unsteady.
And we're now getting systemic haphazard. And that's the real problem. We've never had to confront before.
Yeah. Okay, so is that his major contribution then?
Debt deflation theory, definitely. And I think if people want to get a handle on it, it's a beautiful paper. It's only about 15 pages long. And just search for Debt Deflation, the Theory of Great Depression's PDF, you'll find a copy of it. I think the St. Louis Fed has a copy on the FRED database of the paper. And it's a beautiful statement of a non-equilibrium monetary model of financial instability and breakdown.
All right, that is your homework for this week.
There you go.
Yeah, your answer's in by Friday, please. Richard Goodwin next week.
Yes.
We'll do that as we work through five, maybe six economies. We'll see how long we keep this going for.
Indeed.
We might run out of them eventually, but that's next week. Thanks for that, Steve. Good
Welcome.
To talk to you again.
Yeah.
The Debunking Economics Podcast.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.
If you've enjoyed listening to Debunking Economics, even if you haven't, you might also enjoy The Y Curve. Each week, Roger Hearing and I talk to a guest about a topic that is very much in the news that week. It's lively, it's fun, it's informative. What more could you want? So search The Y Curve in your favorite podcast app or go to ycurve.com to listen.